discuss the dismissal today, and he's unable to be here this morning. We've agreed that he works on the budget for the different committees that he's been assigned to. Having said that, we would like to ask someone to propose the adoption of the agenda, please. Thank you, Honourable Mabasa. Can we have a seconder, please? Honourable Gilbert, thank you. And we then move on to the very first thing, members' reports. Very often, dedicated members like Honourable Mabasa and a few others, Gilbert and Debbie, attend things we don't really get a written report or record of it. And at the end of the year, we say we've done all this work. Can't we have some funds to send members here and there, but we don't have a record. So in future, those members who do attend things in, as it were, almost on their own volition, as it were, that are related to the training industry, working mandate, we would appreciate a one pager. To that end, we've got two reports this morning, and we're just going to allow literally 30 seconds to a minute, starting with yourself, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Thank you, Chairperson. Apologies, that's a two-pager. I'll keep it very brief. Members will have the report in front of them. I'll just summarise the two main points I think I took from the RMB Morgan Stanley Big Five Investment Conference held last week in Cape Town. The conference was quite mining heavy given current events and market concerns. And the first point was, I think, a very good point made by Bobby Godsell and by Richard Kadebe and others, that we really need to take a careful look at the culpability of the South African collective bargaining system and the role it plays in the Marikana tragedy and the role that it continues to play in the difficulties in South African mining. He mentioned in particular the dominant union system, which I described in a little more detail in the report. The second point, Chairperson, which was both something to be proud of and a note of concern, was the fantastic position that South African companies are holding in emerging markets around the world, especially in African and other African economies, but also the concern expressed by many of those companies that they're finding it increasingly difficult to invest bricks and mortar investments here at home, and that for growth in their companies, they are increasingly looking to other African emerging economies and emerging economies around the world, in South America, Asia, etc. And so while it's obviously a point of pride that our companies are doing so well on the global field, we must also take note of their concern that they're not investing bricks and mortar here. In two simple points, Chair, that was the conference really.
No, thank you very much. That was certainly done quite speedily. Honourable Kadebe is not here at the moment, but we will allow that under announcement. And of course, and report. Or otherwise, as soon as if that doesn't happen, we'll do it at the next meeting. Thank you very much. Now, I should have acknowledged another member of Parliament who's not normally in attendance on this committee, but some of the issues are of interest to the party this morning, and she has the space, and that is Honourable Cheryl Lynn Dudley from the African Christian Democratic Party. Is that correct? Thank you very much. Okay. We now go on to the second item, and that is the, we call it product labelling, really. And there are three different organisations here with us this morning who are going to be commenting on it in this area. And that is, in turn, we have with us the Open Shakuda Street Organisation, and we have Mr. Gucky Akbar, the same organisation, Jonathan Dockney, Stephen, and the Nada Boy. And then we have the South African Zionist Federation, Mr. Avram Pringle, Chairman of the South African Zionist Federation, the South African Jewish Board of Deputies represented here, Ms. Wendy Kong, National Director of the SAJC. Right. Of course, there are many other members here. We will announce DPI on here. I think I'm appointing one or two for the DDG. So that's Mr. Zakorda. Because I don't see him, you see.
Apologies for him. He's not here. He's got a... He won't be attending. And on that occasion, I'm saying that he won't be coming to this.
And then Mr. Jeff Ndumo, Chief Director there, Ms. Kukumore, and Mr. Rahul, who's sitting in the front, and of course, Advocate Stradham, we have with us this morning. On that note, then, I'd like members, when they make their input from the different organisations, to refrain from reading word for word the several pages we have in front of us, but rather to highlight the key issues as you see them. And I'm hesitant to say that this can become a very sensitive discussion and engagement and deliberation. We would like always to refrain from explicit statements, if I can put it that way, and rather to deal with the matter quite solely. So over to yourself, Ms. Buckmuster, and I correct on that, you
Morning, Comrade Joan and all members, and thank you very much for, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity to give evidence this morning. The critical thing for all of us is that today, globally, Israel is the one country that the United Nations was founded by the United Nations in 1947. Through partition, which is the one country where in 1948, at the same time as the National Party came to power, a colony was planted in the Middle East. It is one country in the world where several, countless number of UN resolutions have been ignored. So today our submission is going to take the form of dealing with international law, explaining the international law on which Minister Daly made his decision and the notice is published. We will be addressing the question of South African law and the constitution and government's obligation, and we will be addressing the response of the South African Zionist Federation and the South African Jewish Board of Deputies. Let me start with the international law. International law makes it very clear under the Fourth Geneva Convention, under the Hague Convention, and under the UN Charter, that countries have to live in peace, and that where a people are occupied by a foreign military force, that in fact you have to ensure that you do not transfer parts of your own population into the country that you occupy, or the territory that you occupy. Now what we have is that in 1967, Israel attacked its neighbors. And during that period, the United Nations took a number of resolutions asking Israel to withdraw. What we have is in 1947, when the Arab country attacked Israel, you had Israel going over the partition line, and a line was established called the Armistice Line, under the UN agreement, the UN Security Council agreement. Israel moved beyond that green line and occupied Gaza and the West Bank. Today Gaza is referred to by the United Nations as the single largest open-air prison camp, where enormous and gross violations of human rights take place. Israel has since 1967 established more than 120 unlawful settlements within the West Bank. In particular, I want to refer to the Jordan Valley, where 86% of the Jordan Valley, which is the richest part of Palestinian territory, where Israeli settlers have control over 86% of the land, and Palestinians 6%. Israel controls all of the water and sells Palestinian water back to Palestinian people. at highly inflated prices. Israel's settlements there produce fruit and vegetables, wine and other products that are brought into South Africa under the label Product of Israel. Open Shahada Street laid a complaint with the National Consumer Commission against a company called Ahaba and against a company called Wellness Warehouse. And I would draw the Commission's attention to a letter that we wrote, and you don't need to look at it now, to STV Pharmaceuticals, the complainant in the case against the Minister of Trade and Industry, and after receiving a letter from Wellness Warehouse that stopped the product, and they said that they had informed the importer. We wrote a letter to the importer explaining in great detail the international law requirements and the South African law requirements. Zenandi is going to explain the South African law requirements, but what we want to point out here is that the company suing the government has known at least since November 2010, when we received a letter from the Barnard captive. So the argument that the complainants are not aware, have not been aware of this matter, is false. We have also, there were two processes that we engaged in with the Department of Trade and Industry. We asked them to enforce the law as it stands against companies breaking the law already. And we asked them to ensure that the notice is issued, which another will speak about. Now let me say a few things quickly about the response. The South African Zionist Federation and a number of local political parties organized the march, as is their right, on the minister. They made their submissions on the notice. There are clear problems with the notice as it stands. As you know, many things get drafted badly by government. A very good example is the Sexual Offence Act. And the tragedy of that does not compare to, in a certain way, to this, because that those are submissions. But what the notice does is a notice invites public comment. And no one's right can be affected, no one's right can be affected by public comment unless it's hate speech or so on. What public comment says is that you can, when a notice is faulty, address it and make submissions on the faulty notice. And there are two what I would call substantial errors in the notice which can be remedied and doesn't render the notice unlawful. The first is at the top of the notice, it issues correctly the section under which the notice is issued. In the second section, in the body of the notice, it makes a technical error and says instead of section 24, section 26. So there's an error. And then a serious error it makes, well not so serious, because the UN did issue, UN Security Council did issue a resolution. It says the UN borders established in 1948. What the UN did is had a partition in 1947 and recognized in 1949 the Armistice Agreement. So those are two technical errors that any submission could address. The argument that, and I'll come back to the question of the settlement product. Now what we want is a very clear statement from our government that an unlawful occupation is not all right. The International Court of Justice has ruled in an advisory opinion to the United Nations General Assembly on two things. It said that settlements are unlawful and that the construction of the apartheid, what we call the apartheid wall, is unlawful. It asked all countries to take action, to force Israel to comply with international law. Now, I've stated it in the way that I stated it. They use much more measured language as is appropriate for forums like that. But our job and our government's job is to enforce local rule of law and international rule of law. And the sad thing is that it hasn't done so in relation to Israel up to now. So I'm going to leave it there and hand to my colleague Xander Boy.
The most important constitutional right that is affected by this issue is the right to freedom of expression, which includes the right to impart and to receive information, as was held in the Supreme Court appeal settlement relating to that matter, which is tobacco. And it goes without saying that information that is imparted and received needs to be accurate. The CPA gives effect to these constitutional rights by in its purposes, or in the act's purposes, it relates to how the aim of the act is to empower the consumer, to inform the consumer, and to ensure the consumer is too steady and unfair business practices aren't the norm, and create a culture of responsibility, vigilance, education, advocacy, and activism within the consumer. Consumer framework. Now, when the Act is implemented and when the Act is interpreted, these purposes need to be given effect to. One of the provisions that's effective is the Section 84, which requires that whenever a trade description is applied to a particular product or good, and trade description is defined as including the place, country of origin, that it needs to be accurate, and that the trade description needs to be accurate, and then it will certainly require that people, as well as retailers, not knowingly or whether or not they're able to reasonably find out, or whether or not they are convinced that any trade description is inaccurate, that giving effect to that and not complying with the particular provision is in contravention of the Act. Then now what Section 24.4 does is that it gives the minister the power to require a particular trade description, which includes the country of origin, to product and the category of the product and the category of the good. Now, in interpreting these provisions, I think obviously the purpose of the Act seems to be given effect to. And then looking at the context of the fact that the notice itself does say not very accurately, but it's about the point that that's the recognition of Israel only extends as far as the territory that was last occupied in 1967 war. Now, any territory that was occupied in the 1967 war does not form part of Israel, and this has been held in numerous international provisions and declarations and resolutions in them. But, so then now any product coming from outside those recognized 1967 borders cannot be said to form part of Israel. And any product that comes from outside of that cannot be labeled as coming from Israel because that territory does not form part of Israel. Another important aspect that highlights the importance of the international law provision in terms of the General Assembly resolutions, the Security Council resolutions, is that the African needs to comply with the international law, international customary law in terms of Geneva Convention and Hague Convention, and that the government needs to give effect to those and ensure that whenever they give effect to and implement legislation, they do that in terms of and in compliance with those obligations and international law as it stands right now. And under international law, any territory that was occupied during the 1967 war cannot be taken from part at all. And I guess the minister's notice gives effect to that and is in compliance with that. I mean, the notice isn't perfect, but it needs to be interpreted in terms of the purposes of the Act and the purposes to comply with international obligations and statutory obligations.
You certainly have that time available if you wanted to act, you see, but those can be quite intimidating when you're in Parliament. Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. You carry on?
Okay, thanks very much. I think I'm going to just make a very brief input here to say that as a Jewish South African citizen, and this issue is important to me, and it's important in a number of aspects, but I'll just focus on two. Firstly, I think there needs to be a perception of the diversity of views within the South African Jewish community, so that's maybe why I'm sitting in a different position to the organisations that represent Jews, but not all Jews subscribe to the organisation on every issue, and on this particular issue, I feel quite strongly that as a South African citizen, it's part of a world that, you know, where goods cross borders very quickly, so the only way you can personally impact on situations in other parts of the world that we don't agree with is often through deciding what we buy. And so our consumer rights become a way of expressing our views on what's happening in other parts of the world. And in this particular context, the occupation is a problem for somebody like myself, and therefore I would like the right to be able to choose whether or not I want to buy goods from this particular part of the world. And therefore, by expressing my consumer right, I make a decision that represents my view on the unacceptable occupation of the territory, the occupied territory. So that's really where I stand on this matter.
Thank you very much.
Last word would be two things. Stephen also has a letter that we're handing in, which comes from a running South African Jewish people, where just said that things will be noticed. And then we also like to draw your attention to a notice issued by the European Union requiring all products from the occupied territories to not get customs free duties. And they actually published a list of all the postal codes in the occupied territories, which is Israel, France, and Japan.
Thank you very much. We have here with us Islam members and visitors. I'm not sure of the name of the school, and it's unfortunate that I don't have a two-way radio to get it. But you are very welcome. You can see we host Democracy in Action here in Parliament, where the topic is about the labelling of goods, you know, broadly speaking, without going into it. And when we sit at the committee, people raise issues about certain notices that have been published by government, departments. So we give those who wish to have an opportunity to express themselves so that eventually the committee itself will deliberate in a reasoned manner about the concerns that have been raised here. So that's what's going on at the moment, and the committee is Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry. You're very welcome. Thank you. Now, members, we're just going to allow the moment of very short clarification, not anything else, because we want all the presentation, but there may be a clarification that requires, and then we move on to the other two sections as well. Thank you very much for being here. On our last time, I know it's been a really important time for us to see. And before you came, I said, it's amazing how every supplementary chair wound up in hospital. Thank God, nothing seems to be. But here we are. And if I may just call up at this point, the committee members, are there any clarifications you require? Honourable Mabasa?
No, the clarification that I require is from the input that has been made what is the expectation, you know, of us, in other words, what is expected of the community?
Thank you very much. And that, of course, is the Open Intuitive Street organisation that Mike will also be working. Yes, Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, I'm quite happy by your courteous, my colleague Dudley has done, but it's a bigger freaking see me. Madam Chair, are you going to let us have all our questions at the end, or can we ask questions on each presentation?
No, because our time constraints and also need for you to have a holistic understanding, I thought at this point, let us just get a clarification and make your notes on the questions, you see. And I think that would make for a far more interesting engagement.
Sure.
So there's just one clarification here, addressed to yourselves then.
I think from our point of view, the first thing is it shows again that Parliament and the government is willing to listen. And that's very important to us. I think that should be important to every person in South Africa. The second thing is, because the matter is in court, we wouldn't expect the committee to issue a statement on it, because the matter, well, I don't know if it's an interrupt to issue a statement, but it may be considered sub judice. We would like the committee to state a very simple fact that products that entered South Africa ought to be properly labelled to allow consumers to make the choice.
Right, so I hope that's clear. Right. Now, I want us to also listen right now, take this on board, and that is the second item here. We have the input from the South African Zionist Federation on product labelling. And people from there, they'll say, I think Mr. Avram Kringle, the chairman of the South African Zionist Federation, who will make that particular input here. And over to yourself, because there's one of you, it doesn't mean to say you get a short amount of time. You still get the same amount of time, so please don't panic. Okay.
I'll assist you on top by shortening the time allocated to Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of this Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry. Thank you for inviting my organisation to present its views to you this morning. I'm Chairman of the South African Zionist Federation, the umbrella body of all organisations within the South African Jewish community that supports Israel and its people. We represent South African Jewry in all aspects of its relationship with the state of Israel. And our affiliate organisations have membership in the tens of thousands. The issue on your agenda today is one which greatly troubles South African Jewry. And I, together with my fellow representative from the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, Wendy Carr, will try to explain why. According to press reports, the Minister of Trade and Industry, Rob Davies, addressed this very same committee last Friday regarding the labelling of goods produced in the West Bank. It is reported that he stated that he was unaware of any ongoing litigation concerning General Notice 379 of 2012, issued by him on 1 May 2012 and published on 10 May 2012. I find this statement of the Minister's puzzling in light of the Minister's personal and intimate involvement in every aspect of the aforesaid notice and the process that has followed thereafter. What the Minister should have stated is that on July the 5th, 2012, SDV Pharmaceuticals as first applicant and the South African Zionist Federation as second applicant served notice on the Minister that on a date to be arranged with the Registrar of the Mortar 10 High Court, the applicants intend to make application for an order in the following terms, declaring that General Notice 379 is unlawful, interdicting the Minister from taking any steps and any decisions pursuant to the notice, and reviewing and setting aside the notice. While in the Minister's eyes, this may simply be yet another court application against his department, for the South African Zionist Federation, In the Jewish community of South Africa, these court proceedings are unprecedented and unique. The South African Zionist Federation is the oldest national organization of South African Jewry and was founded in 1898. In its 114 years of existence, neither it nor any other organization within South African Jewry has ever litigated against a minister of the South African government. Since 1994, the ANC-led government of South Africa has engaged and interacted with South African Jewry at all levels. As a community, we have always felt that the door to government was wide open for us to discuss any matter which was of concern to the community. We have always been met with the same warmth, dignity, and respect as has and was shown to us by Presidents Mandela, Mbeki, Motlanthe, and Zuma, and all of their respective cabinet ministers and deputy ministers. While in the past 10 years, especially on aspects of the government's statements and policies towards Israel, we may have differed and argued, it was always done in an atmosphere of mutual respect and with an understanding that South African Jewry was a key stakeholder in respect of the government's interaction in the Middle East, and continuous engagement between government and the community through its leadership bodies in the form of the South African Jewish Board of Deputies and the South African Zionist Federation has occurred. This extensive engagement has allowed the South African Jewish Board of Deputies and the South African Zionist Federation to explain government's position to our community and allowed us to assist government in avoiding any unnecessary or inadvertent action which will lead to hurt and offend our community. Our discussions have and are often sharp and robust, but the trust between us has never been broken. We may differ on a narrative of the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but we are united in our vision for the future, which is of a sovereign, democratic Palestinian state being formed in the territory of Gaza and the West Bank, as negotiated with the State of Israel, and with mutually agreed land swaps acceptable to both parties. The Palestinian state will finally be able to fulfill the aspirations of the Palestinian people and will live in peace and mutual prosperity side by side with the democratic Jewish state of Israel. We believe that the South African government and its people have a crucial peacemaking role to play in ending this century-long conflict. To do so, however, it must engage with all parties, as it has done successfully in numerous conflicts in Africa and throughout the world. The South African peacemaking way is unique. We have largely avoided any forms of public condemnation and sanctions against one or more of the parties involved in a conflict, whether it be Zimbabwe, Sudan, DRC, Burundi, Libya, Ivory Coast, or Syria, and have always encouraged and facilitated continuous dialogue and negotiation between all stakeholders. The reason I have come to address the Portfolio Committee today is because I believe that Notice 379 and the process the Minister intends to follow thereafter will cause serious damage not only to the relationship between South African Jewry and South African government, but also to this government's ability to assist and participate in the successful conclusion of a negotiated settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. I state this for the following reasons. Firstly, the South African Jewish community was deliberately excluded from any participation in the formulation and drafting of Notice 379 and its contents. Secondly, as will be more fully described by Wendy Tom, our single meeting with the Minister was entirely unsatisfactory. We encountered an environment of hostility and dismissiveness that I have never experienced in my decades-long engagement with this government. Third, a technical issue of labelling of groups that should be dealt with at a government-to-government level between Israel and South Africa is now a source of conflict between two minority communities in South Africa, and has alienated and isolated a community that contributes enormously to this country. Fourthly, the wording of the notice and cabinet approval thereof effectively means that South Africa has joined the campaign to disinvest, boycott, and impose sanctions against Israel as propagated by Open Sugar Street. I wish to point out that this is not the policy of any country involved in trying to bring peace to the Middle East, including Brazil, Russia, India and China, which, to my knowledge, have not embarked on similar labouring legislation. The notice itself is badly worded to the point of being meaningless, and according to the legal advice we have received, is fatally flawed for various reasons, including the minister assuming power he does not have in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, and usurping the complaint mechanism specifically provided for in the Act. A particularly problematic sentence in the notice is the following. The burden for proving where the products originate will lie with traders. In challenging the lawfulness of the notice and in respect of this particular sentence, the South African Drivers Federation's application to the High Court states the following. The respondent seeks in the general notice to burden traders who are not a category of person dealt with in the Consumer Protection Act with an onus or burden of proof with respect to where the products originate. This too is an exercise in impermissible rulemaking unauthorized by the Consumer Protection Act and ultra vires the powers conferred upon him. Later on in our papers, we state on the very same sentence, also vague and incapable of reasonable comprehension is the phrase, the burden from proving where the products originate will lie with traders. Firstly, there is a resounding lack of clarity as to what the burden will be and how it is proposed to operate. That is it rebuttable or irrebuttable? Is it a mere evidentiary onus or a more substantial onus? What is the consequence of failing to discharge the burden and the like? Secondly, there is uncertainty arising from the use of the word traders. When the law is had to the fact that the Consumer Protection Act expressly defines in Section 1 what is meant by a distributor, importer, producer, retailer, service provider, and supplier, the reference in the general notice not to any of these defined terms, but rather to an undefined use of trader seems almost calculated to confuse. This uncertainty is exacerbated by the fact that it is unclear in terms of which provisions of the Consumer Protection Act the respondent purportedly derives the power to unilaterally determine any of these issues. In conclusion, and for the reasons provided above, I request that this committee prevail upon the Minister to withdraw General Notice D79 and to reassess the manner in which he wishes to label goods produced or partly produced in conflict regions throughout the world. As a community, we will fully cooperate in any future process that is fair, transparent, and respects the rule of law and the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. Thank you.
I'm not sure if you finished. Okay, fine. When I say finished, obviously not finished completely, but just the journal on that issue. I just ask you to turn off the mic. I think that's not. Thank you very much, Mr. Kringle, isn't it? Just to make sure that I've got it right. That will immediately, if there's any clarification on this particular one, you may see that it is immediately followed by the South African Jewish Board of Government. It may be preferable to get them both together. Okay. I'm just speaking, I'm sorry, the point from the advocate of DTI on a particular clarity, and you know, it's always why they have can share with us as you want. Thank you. Can we please move to Wendy Kahn, whom we have already introduced as well from the Jewish Hall of Government. She's a board of deputy.
Yes, thank you.
Sorry about that. Okay. So over to yourself immediately. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Committee. I'd firstly like to thank the Portfolio Committee for allowing us the opportunity to share with you our concerns regarding the proposed legislation, Government Gazette No. 379/2012. The South African Jewish Board of Deputies is a representative body of South African juries, and it is our responsibility to engage with government on behalf of our community. In the majority of our interactions with government, we deal specifically with South African issues in the context of the needs and concerns of the Jewish community and the role it can play as an involved and constructive part of the greater society. At times, however, we consider it necessary to also speak up on matters relating to the state of Israel. This is in light of the strong emotional, religious and ethnic bonds that most of South African Jews have with Israel and the widespread distress that results from perceived threats to its relationship with South Africa. I would like to say from the outset that we are not opposed in principle to the accurate and correct labelling of products. In fact, we applaud DTI's vigilance in wanting to provide full labelling disclosure for the consumer. What we do object to is the manner in which the process has been synthesized. To the country-specific and discriminatory nature of the proposed measures and to the fact that the necessary consultative processes have not been followed by those driving the process. From September 2011 to May 2012, we wrote on 53 occasions to the Minister of Trade and Industry's offices, requesting a meeting in which we could voice our concerns and discuss possible solutions that would still address the requirements of the consumer while not causing distress to our community. Unfortunately, the record shows that the Minister chose not to meet with us, opting instead only to hear representations from Open Charter Street. He thus decided to go ahead with the government gazette notice after hearing the views solely of one small lobby group with a distinct political agenda, while rejecting the input from the representative body of South African jury, a body also with a distinct interest in this matter. Following the furore that the notice caused, and only after intervention of the presidency following our request for assistance in this matter, the minister did finally agree to meet with representative Jewish leadership. This meeting, however, proved to be little short of hostile. It was characterized throughout by the minister's overtly disdainful attitude towards our concerns and complete lack of interest in either debating the merits of the objection raised or finding alternate and less confrontational ways of introducing the legislation. Declining to engage or debate the points raised, he simply brushed them aside with a dismissive comment that if he objected, we were welcome to putting a written submission. His hostile attitude continued long after the meeting, with our community being excluded from the process, and with the media being our only access to important information on an issue that deeply affects us. We did, in fact, prepare such a submission, which was presented to the Minister's offices in June 2012. Much to our surprise, in a news article in Harare newspaper by Jeremy Gordon on the 23rd of August, the minister was quoted as saying that there was no need for further consultations with anyone. I will tell you that the overwhelming thrust of most of the submissions was in the direction in which we were headed. We were frankly astounded by this assertion on the minister's part. We were privy to many of the submissions that were presented to the minister's office, both from the Jewish and Christian communities. And I can assure the body that these officials were in no way supportive of the notice in the way that was being applied. It is a pity that there has not been more transparency in terms of the content of the submissions received. The Minister's refusal to consult further was, in our view, wholly inconsistent with government's commitment to consultation and stakeholder involvement. In the same article, the Minister stated that the legislation is basically a done deal following a cabinet member. If the Minister had taken trouble to meaningfully consulted us in the way that this Portfolio Committee is doing, he would understand that we are not opposed to the legislation. he would realize that we are very reasonable in terms of our understanding of the situation. We have suggestions and proposals that could result in a compromise that would satisfy the various parties. Much of the disquiet felt by South African Jewish Order deputies, which was shared in some way by the above-mentioned parties that also made written submissions, was the manner in which this notice was worded. The effect of that wording was to overtly politicize what was supposedly a technical trade issue related to consumer protection. From both a legal and historical perspective, the reference in the notice to occupied Palestinian territories is deeply problematic. The territory that the minister refers to is disputed land, as this time it belongs to neither Palestine nor Israel. It was determined following the Oslo Accords agreed to by both parties that this area would be considered a territory that would be subject to negotiation between the two countries, and that until the agreement was reached, its status would be in abeyance. While we understand that in these terms it is technically correct to label products emanating from such disputed areas as being products of Israel, it is just as incorrect to refer to them as being produced in occupied Palestinian territories. It is not for South Africa or any other country to unilaterally determine the ownership of the disputed region, whose status remains subject to the terms of a final settlement between the parties directly concerned. We are cognizant and distressed by the suffering of the region, and the South African Jewish Order deputies have repeatedly endorsed the view, one that is held by the greater part of the international community as well as our own government, that the Israeli-Palestinian question must be resolved by means of a negotiated two-state solution leading to the creation of a viable state coexisting alongside Israel in peace and mutually secure borders. This notice, however, is in no way helpful in assisting the peace process that we all long for. It functions mainly to further polarize the parties. The key in achieving that goal, however, can only be through a negotiation process between the parties concerned and not through unilateral pronouncements from outside parties, particularly when such pronouncements prejudge the issue in favor of one or the other, as the minister's notice clearly has done. It is for the above reasons that the South African Jewish Society feels deeply uncomfortable about this term and has on several occasions requested that the minister work with us to find a term that more accurately and with a minimum of provocation describes the reality of the objects and the territories concerned. We have made several suggestions, such as labelling the product according to the town, city or goods from where it originates. In this way, the purpose of accurate labelling of place of origin is accomplished in an accurate and less confrontational manner. Minister Bailey told this committee last week, with the matter having been raised, what do we do? Do we ignore? No, Minister Bailey, but before you go forward with a notice in the government today that you know will cause much distress and anxiety within a proponent of the South African population, you at least meet with the stakeholders representing those constituencies to ascertain whether there is a way to achieve the same result without unnecessarily antagonizing them. The minister's dismissive attitude towards the mainstream Jewish leadership and the overtly biased, politicized wording of this notice has fostered a suspicion that the ultimate goal is not to resolve a consumer protection matter through more accurate product labeling, but rather a punitive action against Israel carried out at the behest of an anti-Israel lobby group. Deputy Minister Marius Franson has since reinforced this belief in a speech given in Athlone on the 14th of July, in which he said, "I am glad to inform you that our government, through the Ministry of Trade and Industry, has recently released a government notice as a strategy to apply economic pressure on Israel." I now will raise the question of country-specific discrimination. Has the intention been to introduce more accurate labelling of products from disputed territories in general? It would have been unnecessary to single out only one such disputed territory. The notice could have spoken of labelling of products originating from disputed territories. It could have been applied to all international zones that are considered occupied, such as Northern Cyprus, Western Sahara, Tibet, and Kashmir, to name but a few. But no, the notice ignores these other dispute areas and focuses only on the case involving the Jewish state. If the intention is to provide the consumer with clear knowledge of place of origin, why only concentrate on this one area? The discriminatory nature of the legislation provides further evidence that its aim is not enhanced consumer protection, but rather the pursuit of an anti-Israel political agenda. In the words of the Deputy Minister, to apply economic pressure on Israel. In light of this, we would question whether this punitive action is consistent with our government's international relations strategy of even-handedness in dealing with foreign conflicts. For example, on the 20th of July, South Africa abstained from a resolution at the United Nations Security Council because it favored one side of the conflict. And according to Deputy Minister Ibrahim, we felt the resolution was unbalanced. It only targeted the Syrian government. Last month, Mr. Ibrahim made the following comments at a letter conference in Pretoria. Although South Africa prefers that countries solve their own problems and without interference from our side, there is often a need for the international community to play a meaningful role in an impartial manner when countries are unable to solve their issues peacefully. These noble international relations principles of balance and impartiality are notably absent from proposed legislation. All we are looking for is for this legislation to protect the rights of the consumer by providing them a right to know without using unnecessary inflammatory terminology. Since no bilateral trade agreement exists for Israel, the labor legislation is governed by the WTO regulations, which clearly states in relation to rules of origin that they are required to be administered in a consistent, uniform, impartial, and reasonable manner. They must clearly be defined and may not of themselves create restrictive, distorting, or disrupting effects on international trade. The singling out of Israel, as well as the intentionally provocative and accurate term occupied Palestinian territories, does just that. Minister Davies has often mentioned that this labeling legislation has already been in operation in the European Union, but in fact is being disingenuous. He fails to explain that the EU and Israel have a bilateral trade agreement, including free trade, and that this preferential arrangement cannot include a disputed region that is not considered part of Israel. In other words, the issues here revolve entirely around technical trade-related concerns and bears no resemblance to the clearly politically driven process that has been introduced in our country. The scenario is based on customs principles and not with political agendas as with the South African scenario. The EU and UK do not use the term occupied Palestinian territories in their labelling, but rather use customs entry codes or the names of towns of origin. They achieve their technical objectives without causing offence. It's a complex situation, and the reality is that it affects South Africa and Israel little in financial terms. But the divisive impact that Minister Davies' labelling strategy has on the two communities in South Africa that have been forced into this very unpleasant and very avoidable fray is enormous. Has the Minister agreed to one of our 33 meeting requests and consulted with us? We could have avoided the very public national and international spat that has ensued. It could have prevented the anti-polarisation process that has resulted in the Jewish and Muslim communities, each desperately drumming up support for and against this legislation. We are perplexed by the zeal with which this process has been embarked on to the detriment of the social adhesion process that we participated in earlier this year. Again, we have no problem with labeling products according to origin. However, let's do this to a genuinely open, constructive, consultative process in which all stakeholders have a right to their input. Through this, we as South Africans can arrive at a solution that enables us to feel comfortable with the final result of fully ensuring that the technical trade requirements of the matter at hand are fully complied with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. If we could just turn the mic off, thank you. Now, members, I know that you saw the cognizance that tea break was scheduled for now, but we did start late, you know, and it wouldn't really be suitable for us to break at this point, I think. What I would like to draw members' attention to are just three things, and I think this committee has always handled such issues when they come up. very incompetently taking all the circumstances into account. There's a need for us to be aware that yes, there's legislation on the table, there are certain requirements with respect to that, but on the other hand, there's also the need for us to be aware that in this particular issue, on one hand, countries involved in civil faith, and South Africa is made up of many different groupings of people. But I do know that we will handle this in a mature manner. And I would certainly like those whose main input here to get a clear understanding. You're not talking to a minister, of course, you are talking to Parliament with a committee here, and there is a decision that will be taken here, or a position that will be forwarded, whatever that position is. I just want one little sharing of information. A lot has been, reference to a notice that was published, has been referred to by almost everyone. And I would certainly like just one thing to be done by the advocate Johan Strader is purely on the notice. That is all. Not anything else, but the issue of the intention, etc., because we are aware that a final set of regulations, if I can put it that way, will be forthcoming. But if you could just contextualize the notice, per se, for us on a technical level. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I came to this meeting with nothing in my head but cooperative and related legislation. I apologize for that. And before I say anything, please allow me, Madam Chair, to say the following. I've been sitting here listening to what is a rather sensitive and delicate, but unchecked, all the observations that have been made. Unfortunately, I can't sit here this morning and speak from the ministerial perspective. I'm not in a position to do so. Please let me add the following as well. Before I do take the liberty just to make some observations in respect to the letters, purely from a legal perspective. I was not party to any correspondence or discussion that preceded the publication of the letters, nor was I party to a notice that we are being told have been drafted badly. But be it as it may, allow me simply also in the interest of time just to make a single comment. If we, I believe we all have the notice before us, as I said. In fact, right at the outset, this is the Minister speaking, I, Dr. Ross Davies, intend to issue a notice. I will not read the rest. So, as a matter of law, it should immediately be clear to all of us that this notice places no, in law, no onus or legal requirement on any party whatsoever. The Minister merely expresses the intention to publish a notice. If we read on later, I will not reflect on the issue that was raised with respect to the burden of proof. I believe that court papers have been filed, and it would be inappropriate for me to say anything. Maybe apart from saying that it is surprising that we get court proceedings intervening on a matter where a legal notice has not been issued. We are, in a sense, speaking on a speculative basis, because if we read the notice further, we will see that the Minister is actually inviting comment within a period of 60 days. Needless to say, that will be considered, and thereafter, the Minister might exercise his discretion to make a notice in law. But this one is purely an intention and is on a speculative basis. I've said that, I hope with great satisfaction, Madam Chair, if you would allow me to leave it at that. Thank you.
Now, I'm very pleased you did just underline those legal pointers, and myself, without wanting to put any pressure on any committee member, one needs to recall that in the past we had positions put forward by the department or the minister that this will be done by a particular date and invite comments, only to have extended by a year. So the intention, it does indicate, of course, 60 days here per se, But you can see in so many ways we are already outside of that from what I understand, because this was published only in May, and if you think of it, May, June, July, August, I mean, we all know what a month is, 30 days, you know, you're way longer, 60 days. So I think there is certainly an awareness that people would like to comment, and that the minister and the department are making, that giving that opportunity. That's how I see it in practical terms. But I would like to advise people not to go down the street of the court case, or the impending, or even the fact that may be coming, and so on, because we're not aware of any dates to say if I'm correct on my understanding of that. But I wouldn't like us to go down something that could be ruled sub judice, and I hope people understand that. Am I clear? Thank you. Right. Over to yourself then, Honourable Dudley. And let me see by show of hands. I see one, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Vandenova, Honourable Kagere.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on this point, it was in fact a minute that came out from a cabinet meeting just a couple of weeks ago that confirmed that this was going ahead. So I don't have it in front of me, and I think it might be helpful if we actually get those minutes and see what that wording says. Because it clearly was a decision taken in a cabinet meeting in this regard. And then my clarity question would just be for the Finance Federation. When Shuhada was speaking, they said they summed up by saying what they wanted was products that enter South Africa should be properly labelled to allow choice. So are you in fact agreeing with this statement, but suggesting that the minister does not meet this objective? Would it be right to say you want the minister to perform the notice and address the issue of labelling in context of all disputed territories in all parts of the world, and not specific to Israel as a discriminatory action?
We have responses afterwards, so if all members of those who made submissions would just make a note of it in writing, and I think from time to time you would understand that indeed you are being required to respond to it. Right. We then had Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, thank you for that opportunity. I think it's great that we hear every point of view, and I must give you credit, Madam Chair, for hearing stakeholders, as we now call them, or vested interests, or whatever they might be, because it's important to observe the law of all the opponent parties on the other side. I find myself, Madam Chair, a little puzzled, and purely from a DTI perspective. I think the advocate has made a point which, when I actually read this notice, I said to myself, really, we're rushing ahead of ourselves. The minister has not actually published notice. He has simply said that he intends to publish a notice, and I must compliment Ms. or Mrs. Khan on her pointing out that in fact some wording, although this is not a legal notice, is a bit broad enough to drive a bus through, and I think one needs to bear that in mind. So I think, Madam Chair, with respect to the ladies in the room, I don't think we need to get our knickers in a knot. There's no notice, actually. There's only an intention. So I think we should be aware of that. The issues, as I said, from purely a DTI technical perspective, that we refer to as a World Trade Organization, it's a trade issue. And I think we as a committee feel very strongly that products should be labelled or sources of origin accurately. And I remember in this committee we drank a bottle of apple cider that was produced in Spain. And we didn't enjoy that. I see notice now they're all produced. I don't know, they certainly send the apple juice in bulk now and bottle it. But the point is, incorrect labelling is an international, well, not crime, but it's completely against the World Trade Organization to allow incorrect labelling. And I'm pleased that Mrs. Khan emphasizes that there's no way that the Jewish community objects to that. So I think it's a matter of finding how do we label it, as it were. Then we get the emotional issue. I don't really want to go into that in GTI. I'm a keen supporter and believer in one of the three famous Abrahamic religions. So I understand all of that emotion and concern, and I try to understand it from my perspective. But what I do have just one or two questions to this Open Shehuda Street group. First of all, I'm sure the name Shehuda Street can be certain symbolism, or maybe we could hear about why they've chosen this name. Then I would like for them to say, what do they think should the label be? Obviously, we have to do it as a country in terms of our World Trade Organization obligations, but what would they like to see? Bearing in mind there's a green line, which we know about. We know there's a post-1967 line, which again came into existence because of an invasion and a victory in a war situation, which goes on for centuries and millennia through the history of mankind. But what does Urban Shehuda Street think we should do? And if the labeling can't be right, I want to ask them, do they want these manufacturing facilities to be closed? Because Madam Chair, I think we must understand that Israel is a booming economy. And in fact, one of their problems is a huge numbers of people attempting to get into Israel. And they have very similar problems to what we've got about that. You know, we have substantial numbers of economic refugees, many, many more than they have in Israel. But in Israel, there are a lot of people from Africa who are getting into Israel through the Egyptian borders and across the desert. And why are they doing it? Because it's a better life, economic refugees. And that sends a message. And I just hope you could tell us, are they in favour of the Israelis helping to establish these manufacturing facilities, or would they prefer to have them closed?
Yes, indeed. Whatever form of freedom you're speaking of or making, Tosh, the input is quite colourful. Yes. Honourable Vandalism?
Yeah, I think this is still on clarification, so mine will be long past that, so I can't clarify, can I? Okay. Chair, I want to know what the status of the court challenge, because I don't really understand that properly. Both presentations, the first one and the first couple and the second thing mentioned the 5th of July as a point at which a court cases were lost. Now, I would like to understand what that court challenge is and what the status of the court challenge is, because then we are not permitted, in terms of the subjudicated rule, to discuss the contents of that in a public forum. So I think we need to understand that. And that was my point of clarity, and I would like to come back perhaps later if we can get that clear.
Honourable
Kadeza. Very chair president. I think some of the person who left to thank all the presidents for having put their names in the committee. And then what I would like to highlight here is across the board is the issue of mutual respect, the issue of mutual recognition. I think on that regard, it makes our job easy, because as a professional trade industry, because you cannot forget that the South African government has a rule of the state, the South African state has got a policy around this issue. The issues you are dealing with men, of which went by all the people that recognize each other, that they must recognize the Palestinians, must recognize the Israelis, and then they must get mutual respect and say that aspect is very clear. Also, what is also important here is the issue of the respect of law, because we've got a law, yes, in the country, which must be respected. I think with that certainty, it is alleviated a lot of pain in our shoulders. But what else? This case is still in court, Chairperson, of which I'm also agreeing with the Zionist Federation that it is not a good precedent to do this, that we have this issue in court. Yeah? Because the best thing to resolve any only issue is by discussion. price discussion. That's what I'm going to do in life. If people are in conflict, put them in their home, take water away, take food away. Give them the whole week until they come up with a solution. That's the first way of resolving conflict. But I think that in the interest, I think that as a responsible state, South Africa will ensure that it abides by the international conventions. I think that's what is critical. You cannot go proceed that. That's why I think that we're going to become that one because of half of the international community. You know, also I feel that the dragon of the South African people was also an international struggle. So I think that we respect the resolutions that are coming from the United States. We respect the resolutions that are coming from the country, but also we respect the resolutions of our own law. Because you cannot respect the laws of the international convention that is sitting at our own law. So the issue of labor in the country is critical. You cannot go with that. We must know where the products are coming from. So the issue here is the issue of technology, which is the core of this business. So I think this guy will see that. Let us take him for a bus that someone in her manner, and then let them search out, and then we can do an interview. Of course, really, we're very happy to have the Palestinian Authority, which is independent and strong, but also a very strong Israeli state. I think for that matter, we are not just what we want in South Africa. And I think that with the work done by human beings, I think that's what we want to address. The issue of training, I don't think that the South African government is also the intentional discriminator against anyone. It's my definition of oversight in the statutory fight. That thing can be resolved through negotiation. I can make an example here. When we speak about Western Sahara, really, take the trade flow between Morocco and South Africa. It's negligent then. So go and put it on paper, it will be like wasting the resource of things. But if the thing comes up next, well, we have to confront that, they will have to confront that. We'll never let it lie down as if nothing has happened. But I feel that this issue of international is this problem relationship between South African and the Palestinian people. That's why I think it's coming. But I think that their people, the children of Abraham, we all have a right to exist. That's what we have.
It's so true, so true. I mean, we look at it, not only, of course, as Africa, the cradle of humankind, but yet indeed, there is but one root in some of these states. Honourable Salah?
The question is all over the region, and it's easy enough for the region to say, because of the South West, or inside of the same region, like the South West. On the presentation by the National Director of SNG on refugees in the second last paragraph, where she says the scenario is based on certain principles and not on political agenda, as in the African scenario, and in which as she goes to explain how the EU and the UK did it, was to use the hem, or was not to use the hem, the name, or the name description of what happened, but instead to use custom and green code, or the name of the town of origin, or the name of the town of origin. But it's Harold instead of in Israel. If Israel is coming from a particular town, but indeed that Israel occupied country, this thing comes from a particular town. If you use the name of that town, you are not necessarily saying that it comes from Israel. No. But the second is here, if I call you by code name and I call you by your name, what difference impact, what is the difference in impact of what I mean? But secondly, depending on who you are dealing with as consumer in this respect, how would the consumer know that kind of policy about whether that place is Israel territory or Israel occupied territory? How would the consumer know? So I think the idea is to say because you must know the potential of reason of the particular person.
Thank you very much. I will allow the last one on the local answer.
Chairperson, I think I would like Honourable Mercer and Honourable Mabasa. What is being done? The Congress is a member of the United Nations that is bound by the resolutions and conventions of the UN. It supports the existence, the strengthening and proper functioning of multilateralism. And therefore, South Africa cannot take unilateral decisions outside the resolution and convention of the resolution. But also, South Africa is bound by the rules of the WTO, in this particular instance, the rules of origin. So the current thing that one sees is if there was extensive collaboration on this issue, just outside the legal parameter, what would have been the expectation, what would have been the expected outcome of the collaboration on this matter? Given what I said before. Because it makes it difficult for the committee to really discuss this matter in depth, given the fact that the issue is now in court, but yet South Africa stands in this position of being a member of the UN, a member of the WTO, bound by the convention, and so on. What then is the president, whatever form of convention?
Very much, Honourable Kabata. I think the first point that we should address, that will be addressed all the other points and must be done by both parties, is the issue that has been raised not only by ourselves but by two or three other members of our team in their question of the court having already been approached in this matter. And I do see that you are here yourself, Chief Director, am I right? Nothing yet to attend the right. You're coming in here, and I'm sure perhaps Advocate Craven may be able to assist you if there's anything you need just to clarify. So I'd like it that very briefly for both groupings, starting with those and gentlemen, just to respond to that.
Jefferson, thank you. As far as we know, the court case was launched on 5th of October. We got to hear about 2 weeks ago. For the 5th of July, we got to hear it 2 weeks ago. We're going to join in the party. So we're making very clear that we're joining in the party. If the South African Zionist Federation doesn't withdraw the court case. So that's where the matter stands. We also know that 5th of July is 5 days before the notice was up. We also know that the South African Zionist Federation, or the Jewish Board of Deputies, made a Promotion of Access Information Act request to the minister from the court papers and didn't allow that process to take its go to its conclusion. As far as we know, no dates have been set down because we couldn't get any response from anyone, either the department nor anyone else. But just quickly to say that we had put pressure on the minister, and we had also, as Director Chitenze told you, said we've been waiting for a year for the notice to be issued, not a little bit more, and we ourselves threatened legal action, which we hope we didn't have to do.
I think
the
issue of the legal action, we could be mindful, all of us, of what Honourable Kajewi has already stated here. Certainly don't want to be characterised as a nation of litigation, you know. I won't mention a country that has already got that. No, we don't want to take away from that country. But be that as it may, if we do also have the Zionist Association, just to get the proper name, Federation, and the Jewish Board of Deputies, yes, you can both comment because you are different organisations. Okay, right. Yes.
The
So I think we need to first respond to having the stone emphasis of the word intent. The rest states to issue a notice in terms of the Consumer Protection Act to require traders in South Africa not to incorrectly label products that are originated from occupied Palestinian territory as products we don't. It sounds, on the reading of it, rather prescriptive as to what he intends to do. He could have said, we request submissions on the possibility of, it's quite clear what the final outcome of this process will be, and it's already been taken to Cabinet and approved by Cabinet, largely in the manner of which it's set out in this notice. The status of the litigation is as follows. The legal advice which we have received is because the notice is so fatally flawed, and one of its biggest problems is it's not clear what the Minister has already decided and what he hasn't decided. Is that it warranted and we were entitled to in terms of the rule of law, in terms of the Constitution, to challenge it at this stage as part of what I've stated in the submission to compel the Minister to withdraw the present wording of the notice and to enter into the process of consultation that he should have done before. The litigation, if successful, would in a sense undo the entire process and will achieve what we set out to do, which is that the Minister must reassess the manner and way in which he will proceed in this matter. As has been stated and was emphasised in my address to the Portfolio Committee, the decision to litigate was an act of desperation. It was an act of last resort, which only arose because the conduct of the Minister to date had shown that he was deaf and ignored and was dismissive of any contribution which the South African Jewish organisations, which represent the South African Jewish community, were putting to him and placing to him. If a compromise can be achieved, naturally, it is the easiest thing in the world to withdraw a court case. But if the Minister continues on this present path of ignoring our submissions, of ignoring our contribution to this matter, and of demanding that a regulation be drafted with these impossible onus of proof on traders, whatever they may be, to prove that their goods don't come from the West Bank, which actually means that no Israeli product will be stopped because the minute an accusation is made, the retailer or whoever it might be has to then justify and find the documentation to prove his situation, which he simply won't do and will take the products off the shelf. Unless we can reach some compromise, which we believe we can, and from the sentiments expressed in this committee today, we're encouraged by what has been said. We can sit in a room and we can definitely come to some compromise. But that is as much up to the Minister as it is up to us. In terms of where the litigation is, the Ministry is required to give us a record of all documentation that were used and related to this notice, and it is clear that there has been extensive consultation with Open Jewistry for over 2 years before the notice was submitted, and in fact offers to assist in drafting the notice were made by Open Jewistry. Once the record is complete, the Minister will then file his response, and a hearing of the matter will follow shortly thereafter.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Quimble. I think you've certainly contextualised it, but it isn't all that clear, because it seems to me, certainly as chairperson, that your intention to litigate on the matter really is perhaps intended to create pressure in order for the department or the minister rather to do a certain thing. And I think it's that the committee is concerned about. We are deeply concerned that, in one sense, there is a notice, an intentional notice, if I see there are one or two on the technical you know, the facts that have already been alluded to and agreed to by the EGR. But nevertheless, the substantive issue here is that there is this intention to do a particular thing, and 3 months or whatever will be, or 2 months rather, of consultation, which have long been exceeded, in fact, and that's a point I made earlier. And that Parliament had every intention, once we got, someone even referred to a cabinet position, once it came here, it was our intention, as we did from the beginning of this year when it first arose, let's hear what the different stakeholders, I don't want to use the word again, stakeholders have said. We've already heard that the Open Chair itself has contemplated court action. And I think it's all the parties here that need to be persuaded that this is not the most appropriate route to go. I think we do want to recognise that there was a sense of frustration from yourselves as the Jewish Board of Governors and the Zionist Federation, but also Open Shahud has said they tried for 2 years, and no doubt they have a sense of frustration. Do you follow what I'm saying? So what was it, they came to the minister a month before and suddenly got a green light? They've been exercising, I'm not sure what, patience or frustration or what. So I do want to make it clear that I can't take a position now. We haven't completed the deliberation. But I would earnestly hope we can persuade all parties to actually engage. That's our job. The minister, the department, the stakeholders involved, and to fresh this up, to try and get some amicable resolution of the matter that doesn't put, as someone already said, the different states of Abraham, you know, into a conflict. But we cannot ignore that there's an element of such judicata. Yes, an element. And that's what I think the Honourable Member Murphy has raised, and we've also acknowledged. We don't want to fall into that trap. But I'm not going to allow you to respond to everything. But just let me take a quick point from that NAMCO member, Honourable Kovasa.
Yes. Chairperson, you know, one of the responsibilities of this committee is to hold the minister accountable. And the minister sits with a mandate to implement the laws of this country as far as trade and industry issues are concerned. And therefore, he has to, when a matter is brought before him, he has to respond in accordance with the laws of this country. Because if he doesn't, we'll ask him why he's not taking in a particular manner in terms of the money that the laws of the country allow him to take. And so, Chairperson, one would agree that perhaps consultation prior to serving the notice would have been the most appropriate route to take. And I think that is the point that is being made on both sides, I think. But to begin to suggest that the minister might have acted outside the law, I think is incorrect. And I think we need to raise that point. And therefore, and in fact, it put us on the attack on the pattern of the living. And I think we should not allow that to happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Barker. Members, I'm just persuaded here that it may be a good idea to take our 10-minute tea break right now and then get the responses. But so I want to be highly appreciative here.
Chairperson, we've just got a plant catch back to Hannesburg. We're going to need to leave at about 11:30 the latest.
All right, we didn't, I'm glad we've been made aware of this. Well, you see how easy this is from problem up. Okay. Immediately get the chair changing, Hermione. All right. Now, on a more serious note, let's get these responses in. And I think it's very be mindful that each group would like to respond, and that's all I'm saying to everyone. Thank you very much. Yourself, Dartmouth.
I just want to respond to a few questions relating to the law and international law, not the court matter. I want to, the only will explain Maritash, who will have some colourful exchanges with, to the question of the name of Open Shahar Street. And, Steve, I want to respond to something very briefly. If you would recall, the South African Lions Federation made reference to the Oslo Agreement, Oslo 2. And I can just quote from Oslo 2 directly to you. It says, the first thing it says, I'm just going to summarize it for you. Oslo 2 says the following, that the occupation of state area C, the Jordan Bay, and any other occupation of the settlements, in terms of that, Israel is divided West Bank into A, B, and C, with the Palestinian agreement. Area A, which is only about 22 or 23% of the West Bank, is the only area under control of the Palestinian Authority. Area B is civilian control, but it has two systems of law, military and Israeli. Area B and C, the Palestinians are under military law. They've never been able to have their disputes resolved properly, particularly political disputes. Now, in Area C, what Oslo says is that these have to be resolved in terms of Resolution 232. The final status agreement has to be resolved in terms of Resolution 232 of the UN. And if you read Resolution 232, it requires the withdrawal of Israel from occupied territories. It requires the clearly the withdrawal of Israel from that. So the question is, if the parties negotiate, they may agree changing borders over here, a little bit there, but it does not recognize, and it says the territorial integrity of Gaza and the West Bank must be maintained. Secondly, in relation to the onus, I would just directly read from section 24, which on the first instance, all traders are required, you the people who drafted the law, so you know it clearly, all traders are required, so the burden is already on a trader, a retailer, and so on. And a trader is defined as someone, in the English dictionary, very clearly as someone who does business of trade in import, export, retail, wholesale, and so on. So it's very clear what a trader is. Any person in South Africa who sells something has to accurately label if they put a label on something. And that is already not a burden, it's a requirement of the law. And then in section 24.4 or 24.5, the Act says, so you've said to the minister that this is what he has to do. He has to ensure in a notice that he issues. The producer or importer of any goods that have been described in terms of subsection 4 must apply a trade description for those goods, disclosing the country of origin of the goods and any other prescribed information. So it's not simply that the minister has usurped any power, but the power itself comes from the Act and has been given to him by the Parliament. Lastly, I would just like to add that the international law that we have to consider in South Africa are also laws that our Parliament have passed, such as the implementation of the Rome Statute Act, which we can prosecute in this country, war crimes, crimes against humanity and so on. The Geneva Conventions Act, which has just come into force. So members of Parliament will recognise that those are all the laws that our government has to consider.
Thank you very much. People will have further opportunity, but I am conscious that people also have a fight. We're not stopping people from making a contribution, though. But if it's, I would like to ask the Zionist Federation to come in on other questions that were raised, and for that matter, the Jewish Board of Deputies, just quickly to respond. They were not specifically directed to the Jews.
I think the first point to make is that the interpretation of Section 24 is not clear at all. It talks about categories of goods, doesn't even compel an actual label on a good. And if you look at the the regulations that have come out in respect to this, of that, it's normally applies to a generic type of good which is manufactured and put together in different countries, etc. And its main aim is really for the issue of what goods qualify for what preferential trade agreements. And the legal advisors to the Federation, 17 year council, they might be wrong, the court, if compelled to end, will eventually decide to not believe that Section 24, as presently drafted, gives the minister the rights and the powers which he is trying to use in terms of this notice or intended notice or whatever might follow. And in fact, there's a section in the paper that I'm happy to distribute them to this committee which deals with it. There are also extensive submissions that were made by the Board of Deputies, the Chief Rabbi, and various other organisations that deal with the problematic nature of using Section 24 for the purpose which the Minister intends to interpret as much. So really that's an area of dispute. We're not a court of law yet, and I don't agree to take it further. But also the point needs to be made clear that complaints such as what Open Shahuda Street made in terms of the Consumer Protection Act are not for the Minister to adjudicate. They are for the National Consumer Commission. There are specific structures set up in terms of the Act that allow interest groups, etc., to complain, and then it is dealt with through the mechanisms of the Act and what is provided for. In terms of the question, what do we want? I think a very important point that needs to be made, and was quite apparent from Open Shahuda Street's submissions, is the only example in the world where they can give where, in fact, this differentiation of where goods are produced, whether in Israel proper or Area C or whatever it might be, is, in fact, the European Union specifically dealing with the free trade agreement that exists between the countries. This is not a worldwide phenomenon. This is not an issue that has been taken up by hundreds of countries in the developing and Western worlds, or whatever it might be. South Africa, in a sense, would be the first to take the extreme measures that are proposed by the minister. However, having said all that, if the Ministry of Trade and Industry believes that goods from occupied or conflict regions throughout the world should have a specific way of being described, and I can understand in the South African context, there may be people who would be interested to know that goods have come from Tibet and not China, that goods have come from the Western Sahara and not Morocco. For the record, there are South African ships that use the territorial waters of Western Sahara and gain licenses from the Moroccan government to do so. So in a sense, that fish is being consumed in South Africa from an occupied territory. Kashmir would be another area, and I presume because of the local Greek community, North Cyprus would also be an area of interest. If the minister decided that this was an added addition which he wanted to add to the South African labelling clarification and transparency, we would be happy to be part of that process in respect of clearly the West Bank and Gaza. The West Bank would be one of those categories, undeniably so. And as long as there is a uniform way and manner in which the regions are labelled, and the Act is amended to the extent necessary to allow for it to be legally enforceable, we would happily abide by that decision. And as we've said, if all of that was dismissed, there is still a way of labelling these goods as not made in Israel, but not without the inflammatory language that has been presently proposed in both this notice and the governmental notice. In terms of the minister's conduct, again, what has greatly disturbed this community is that exhaustive and extensive submissions were made to the minister, and in terms of his statements to both this committee and in the National Assembly, as well as the press, they do not seem to have had any impact at all
on his decision-making process, and what he intended to do in terms of the original notice seems to be the path which he wishes to continue. I just want to correct one fact provided by Open Chivinsky. The resolution which deals with the creation of a Palestinian state within West Bank and Gaza is Resolution 242 of the Security Council. It is a resolution which Israel actively involves itself in and cooperates with. And what is made clear in that resolution is that the final borders will be delineated at the time when peace is achieved between the nations of the area and when borders are demarcated and the recognition of both Israel and Palestine is achieved. It is important to note that between 1948 and 1967, Israel did not occupy one square centimeter of East Gaza and West Bank. And yet both the Palestinians and the Arab world chose not to create a Palestinian state in that territory because the decision to do so was, in their opinion, would be seen as giving up the claim, the right, in a sense, to destroy the state of Israel and to claim the entire territory as a Palestinian Arab territory. In fact, the Jordanian government formally annexed the West Bank. This was only recognized by both Pakistan and the United Kingdom. The issue is fraught with historical facts, which people contend are correct or not contend. There is a history that goes back, has been set a century, maybe even longer. Surely, the role that South Africa can play more than any other is the role, as I mentioned in my submission, to bring this conflict once and for all to an end. And to do that, we need to engage with both the Israelis and the Palestinians and use the unique skill and expertise which we have brought to bear in our own conflict and in conflicts throughout the world and assist wherever possible to achieve the dream of a two-state solution. These type of inflammatory notices dealing with the labeling of $200,000 worth of face cream, frankly, are not helpful in terms of South Africa's ability to materially impact and affect lasting change in the region.
We have Honourable Davy who wants to say something, and cognizant of your need to leave as well, I'd rather he said it with you present as we have a bearing on the matter. But I must just state that the important thing here is about the labelling, which doesn't only deal with cream, as you say, it deals with a number of things. And from my understanding of what's coming out now, it's really about the process and consultation that is at the heart of this. But let me not preempt things. On what to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I think that it is a possible point of in that case. And I think the problem is that we have to engage in life to deal with the trade issues and maybe this is so. And I think beyond that, but if we can go beyond that, we could take the whatever way can be explained, that was the major point. We will never go to that other. So we don't all want to put that with, you know, we want the issue that the issue of labeling the issue is expected to be in our life. But I think that two is a fact here, what we are expected to make a report. And then really, what I'm asking to, what I assume to have from the electoral delegation, what is the minimum conditions they want, the quality, so that it will give us some sort of an idea of what the energy is being ready. Rest assured, in that moment, who would like to go to, rest assured, or that one. But what are the minimum things to want? You can see that you have extreme frustration. You can also see you have extreme frustration. But what are the minimum things? That's the bottom line. So that can help us. But then everything is changed. I think that also this is a part of the information. The reason why the decision is the community.
and with the means that for those that can accept the community. But when they can, they have to take into consideration what is it. That's why that I want us to be held here, that what are the bottom lines which we like to put out so that when we take our decisions for the important people.
Yeah, I think that that was a very good point. I just wanted to say, I think that we're here and we are all here about Africa. There are no threats and there are no fights against the issue. And we should be able to resolve our differences between ourselves in the spirit that it is intended in our constitution. The second thing I want to say is that I think here today we've all agreed that the law must be observed, both international and domestic law. And the Consumer Protection Act is a recognized law of this land, and that products, therefore, entering this country should be properly labeled. We've all agreed on that. So we've got a lot of agreement going here already. The next thing is that I think we have to underscore in our report that the principle of consultation and mutual respect must also be observed. And I think we've all agreed to that, and I think it's been said by some of my other colleagues. All parties, it would seem to me, prefer not to litigate. Prefer not to, and therefore there should be some way that we can engage in a dialogue through discussion and consultation that hopefully is in a mutually acceptable result. If I were to sum up, I would say that was what I'm hearing today. And I think that my colleague here has raised the question of, let's get, maybe in writing on that chairperson, a minimum requirement of what is for all the parties concerned of vital interest in this matter. And I think those are to me the fundamental agreement and understanding between ourselves. So thank you.
Yes, I was going to say I think it would be more constructive for us if these minimum requirements on either side were put in writing, and you know, we wouldn't want all the history per se, but just, you know, briefly, this is the bottom line, if this could be observed. Of course, mindful of the fact that we have legislation in our constitution, etc. But, of course, the main thing about the Consumer Protection Act, it talks of the intent, not knowingly, on the product. If something is coming from France, let us not say made in Germany, jargon or something like that. We were already, as a country, faced with many international challenges here, where we say, look, you know, this is actually made in this country, and all you've done is add one button. You can't go say made in this country because you added a button. You know, now, we are already involved in that kind of thing, so we wouldn't like to create other precedents. But yes, there may be ways that wording could be addressed and that kind of thing. But there is no way that we don't want the consumer to be informed about products on the shelf, etc. But I must underline the fact that I think Honourable Fadevi was emphasising as well. You know, we're not the Committee of International Relations and Cooperation, and we must be mindful of that. We have this challenge where we deal with financial matters as well, as credit act. We have to be cautious. Well, we're not the Finance Committee themselves. What is our mandate here? And our main mandate, no matter what our personal views are, if you like, that this is a trade and industry matter. And therefore, we reference the labels, although we want to contextualize them. But then, as Honourable Vanda Merwin has observed, we are all South Africans. And I think we've got to find each other. We've absolutely got to. Many countries of the world have held South Africa up as a country of great tolerance. We've got all these faiths here. And I think that everyone sitting on my list here, members, we also come from different faiths. Yes, well, of course, and no faith. I mean, that you are also protected if you are an agnostic or an atheist or whatever. If we just leave it there, we're also not the sort of religious, you know, what do you call it, another committee dealing with that, traditional leaders and the like. You know, we're the trade and industry. And just before you leave, though, I want Mr. MacDonald just to make one statement in this area, if he wishes to. Mr. MacDonald, I'm sorry, Mr. Nancy Tenby is Of course, I can think of Michelangelo, which I call him from time to time, but it is Mr. Nefertiti, is the expert, if you like, in DTI on the planet. One clean, sharp, short statement.
No, thanks, Honourable Member, and the participant. I'm very glad I was late in the cabinet meeting. But in short, is that we received a lot of documentation from a lot of people, including the participant, the two participants. And then we have analyzed them. And the indication is the exact intention of the minister now needs to be brought to fruition. In a sense that we need to comply as we need to do that. And if that will come with a notice, which is not yet final, and probably there will be a change in document to the notice, or with regulation, with ever the minority. But there won't be a final notice without talking to us. We received a lot of the comments, including from the participants. So I hope this is a clear process issue. Let me not comment on the issue of the comments.
I think when you say in two participants that you came a little bit late, you saw two different points of view, as it were, on the table, and there are three different groupings here before us. But let's leave it there. We actually have other legislation to look at, as I'm sure people are aware, but I am going to allow the responses to the questions raised to be made. If there are any outstanding, I'm looking at members, because broadly speaking, the issues have been addressed. Broadly speaking, I'm looking at members on my left here, and everyone's nodding. So if that is the case, it does not mean to say our door is closed. We've asked for the written input. That can be important to us, because we ourselves will exercise our responsibility by briefing the minister, making him aware of our position as a committee. I want to thank you all for coming. You know, from wherever you did, I'm from a longer distance than others. The main thing is you took time off your normal working day and you came here. Thank you. Can we please break for team members? I hope that doesn't mean you're running to the airport.
Thank you.
arrangements with labour and transport arrangements with members. And we were running 35 minutes late to begin with. And that has set us back. But if we look at the situation now, having had a short discussion with the chair of the subcommittee on co-op, Honourable Mabaza, he has also requested more time, just to give a more substantive report. Do I understand you correctly, Honourable Mabaza, from the co-op?
Yes, what I was proposing is that in addition to giving the normal report that we give, which the advocate will lead, you know, in the content areas, it's on the oversight report that we don't go into details in discussing it today, but that we discuss it in the next PC meeting.
Thank you very much. And in order to ensure that we're not looking at fruitless expenditure when members depart and come down, we hope that you're all ready. Oh, you are here, of course. The chief director is here, and the marshal, and well, everyone is here that we need, and of course the parliamentary advocate as well. So let's have a very brief input from yourself then, Honourable Mabaza, if that's all right. And thank you for the guests up ahead. We're just dealing with a piece of legislation on the co-ops, cooperative bills. We all know what co-ops are, and we're having to exercise our oversight on that important piece of legislation. Over to yourself, Honourable Mabaza.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. The subcommittee's last meeting, out of a series of their meetings, has been the one of the late 20th. And I must express a word of appreciation to the members of the subcommittee because continually they honor these meetings on the side of the advocates, on the side of the department and the members of the staff. And also, as we had proposed in the last meeting, on that meeting of the 20th of September, we also had in our presence Adamson, actually Adamson, as our proposal that we make it one meeting because that saves time and the quality of work that comes before the committee is heightened more than if it comes before it is in ahead. But in this instance, she's able to engage in the meeting and the product is a product of everybody. I will not go into the details here because I believe that probably Advocate Stridon will do that. I'll just take you to the second page where the subcommittee proposes that it meets on the 4th and the 5th of October. That will be during the recess period, so that we can push more work. And if I take you to number 16, the subcommittee would like to propose that the committee proceed with document E3 from clause 36. And number 17, the subcommittee also wishes to submit to the committee the following documents, opinion 2 to 4 from Advocate Adamson, additional submissions from Sanago, SACOF, and NACOFSA, and also subcommittee report on the oversight visit to Mpumalanga and the KZN. That's what I spoke of. We then end with that proposal to meet on the 4th and the 5th, so that we receive, but we feel we are getting to the end of the exercise. So, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabaza. You are doing a lot of work in this committee, and I have to commend all members and also the manager and the owner of the leadership. Right, members, yes. Wasn't too sure what that was. Was that my creaking chair or what? But anyway. And then, of course, you know, we have this long-term call, deliberations on the Cooperative Amendment Bill. And you all know where we are with that. I think the way we have been working is for yourself, is it advocate trading to take us through, or is it, what have you proposed, Honourable Mabasa? And I'm sure it's yourself.
It would be from the team of advocates. They do have interchangeably, but they would know which one of them.
I think Madam will take us through, but if I can just explain to members what we have done on document E3 for you, you will note that there is three colors. We've got black font, a purple font, and a red font. The red, the black font is the bill as introduced by combined. The red font is amendments that deal with public comment received, and the response of the DGI on those public comments, as well as comments that might have come out here from the hearings and so on. The purple font is input that we have received from, I think, an Arlington, the expert that was obtained. Now, most of the comments are stylistic, so I think on that point, as this trainer will pass quite quickly through, we'll just explain how we did it for us. But there will be a couple really significant impacts. So just to explain the colours so that you know where you're coming from when you deal with a certain cup, and then I'll hand over to you.
We're all on track, are we not? And yes, we also have, the Honourable Shorty, is it? Satori? Yes, thank you. To you, advocate, Jonathan Strader.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is James Toon from the debate. It's prepared this honourable commission. It is my argument for my own purpose to clarify something that you said. The document that we will be moving on today is the document that is number top left E3. And as far as my mic, is that not that? Is that okay? The number E3 top length, and it starts with clause 39. Now, we will recall that during the previous meeting, we were then moving on the document that was called E2, and we ended off at that meeting dealing with clause number 39. Clause 38 in the bill. And once again, the same sequence as E2 was an extension of E1, E3 is an extension of both E1 and E2, and will eventually culminate into a single document. Needless to say, hopefully after the recess, we will be in a position to move on a single document. And then just one further point of clarity, Madam Chair. For the matter, I've indicated that we've got the black, we've got the red, and we've got indeed the purple as well. Right? And also indicated that the purple emanates from inputs that we found in the psychology from Ms. Anderson. For
I think I'm colorblind, but I only see red and blue and black.
If we refer to the very first page of the document, then it's just below the middle. Paragraph E. Paragraph E just below the middle of E3.
Confirmation in view of my age, to have it quite clear.
can I just confirm, Madam Chair, I mean, they're all on the document. I apologise for that. Document has been a big colour. The open is not as conspicuous as the rest, but I think it will be there for all of us. Can I just ask, Madam Chair, for purposes of this meeting today, I think in the subcommittee we indicated yesterday that it might be worth a while to only move on the rest portion and not refer to the purple one. Needless to say, we will come back to that later. But it has been indicated that the purple ones, they are most of the very legal, technical in nature, not involving any kind of substance. So with your permission, allow me then, if there is a question or an issue raised on the purple issue, needless to say, we will have next week. But for my purposes and your permission, I will move on the end over there.
Agree, the purple's a little obscure, so due to no line of legal opinion, so just move on.
Can we turn to page 3, right at the bottom? It is clause 42, and there we have the rest. Allow me not to deal with the first one, Madam Chair, they really refer to the subsections and the changes there. But there, right at the bottom, a director or employee becomes aware of any error or misstatement in a financial statement, social report, or management decision report, that the former auditor, independent reviewer, or former independent reviewer has reported on, must notify the auditor or independent reviewer without delay. So the yearly and bonus, if there is a statement in that report, to notify accordingly. I move on to subsection 2 just below that, Madam Chair. An auditor, former auditor, and the rest once again, of a cooperative who is notified of, or in any manner becomes aware of, a material error or misstatement in a financial statement, social report, management decision report, on which they have reported to the board, must inform the board and register accordingly. The directors, it is suggested that it be taken out there and substituted by the board and register. Just below that, subsection 3, where the auditor, former auditor, and the rest again, informs the board of an error on the statement in a financial statement, social report, and the rest again, what must the directors do? They must prepare and issue revised financial statements or inform the members and the registrar of the error on the statement. Unless there is interruption, I will simply proceed, Madam Chair. Allow me very briefly just to refer on page 5 at the bottom, right at the bottom, paragraph D, just to that head, in subsection 6.
On the last one, this thing is, we must form the director. The director must prepare and issue revised financial statements, or inform the member and the register of the air. I think they should do both. Because if they inform them and leave the statement as is,
it's a pertinent point that they register here on yourself in our hotel room.
I think, if I remember correctly, the point is made that it doesn't quite differentiate between errors of substance and other errors. So in every case where there's a relatively minor consequential error in the financial statement, they will be required to reproduce the financial statement, which is quite purposeful. So I think the point is that if there's an major error and the financial statement completely misrepresents the true picture, then by all means go ahead and reproduce it. But if not, just inform the error to the members of the error.
Okay, that helps you, Honourable Secretary. We will come to yourself and Minister, Chief Director.
The problem is with the financial statement is that, let's say somebody reads the financial statement without seeing the letter of notification. you need to leave a financial dependent that is correct, 100% correct, when it comes to finances.
Well, financial background indeed. Yes, Chief Director, understand all.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The, I think A needs to be expanded to the depth of A. To the subcategory to the director must prepare and issue a revised financial statement or social report or management decision report. And I think that was completed and I'm now to do that now because it assumes that we're only revising one and then there might be that the social report might need also to revise because there is an error on it as well as the management decision report. And just putting the thing now. With respect to informing both, I think the members must also know about the must know about the error which has occurred, and also the registrar must also be informed accordingly. And now, I don't know whether that's an ideal kind of class at all, because the way it later is a really nice. We believe that it does cover both of them. Because we are ensuring that we're not so good. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
We may, of course, have this, but a last comment from yourself, Advocate Stringer.
It's just informing a little discussion that Chair, on our part, we've got no problems with this. Everything in this
question. Right. So we're having a position we include. Okay, so Honourable Salah, you've got it then. Okay, so we'll just flag that one so that we ensure that when we get the next lot, it's corrected accordingly or amended and all that. Thanks. Do you move on as it is?
Thank you, Chair. I've already referred to page 5, but I think the document is merely a reference to subsection 6. There's no substance there, Madam Chair. The next one is on top of the next page. To read this one properly for those of us who have the principal activators as well. I'll just read really briefly read from here. Yeah. Here I can find the narrative in the chain. It reads in the principal act sub 6. The registrar must issue a certificate of registration in the name of the cooperative to be constituted to satisfy that, and then we have the red portion on top there. So you satisfy that in the case of the conversion of a co-op in another form of legal entity or different form of co-op, registered newly converted cooperative. So the owners of the registrar to register a newly converted co-op. We need no pressure out here today. So we work for that or shall I carry on?
Yes.
Can we just stay on this one for a short while and just discuss something? We're saying in the case of the conversion of a co-op into another form of legal entity or a different form of co-op. So clearly we have two possibilities. The one is a different form of co-op. The other one is conversion into a legal entity. I'm asking, that legal entity might not be a co-op. It might be some other kind of juristic person. Then we must maybe reconsider the words subsequent to that. Registered and newly converted co-op and maybe possibly consider to insert or other legal entity. I'm asking Madam Chair.
Before the committee,
yes, Honourable Barker? No, I agree with the suggestion from Member Taylor. If the meeting at the PC agrees, then we can look into the phrasing.
Fine. So you're saying you wish to return it to the subcommittee just to approve the voting, is that it? Because I thought we were already going to agree here. Honourable Kadebe?
Thank you, Mr. President. I think that is correct. Yeah. I think the process of when it becomes a big business, yeah, instead of the call, it becomes a corporation. It's not covered through the corporation. I think it's correct that you cover that as a country. I think I decide again, man. But once at that time, you know, let's call me.
No, I think it's been accepted, your proposal, yeah.
To be honest, better too. Maybe in the process of drafting, we should have done that in the debate. Thanks for
watching.
All right, we move. I'm moving to page 8. Very simple, the insertion in clause 51, Madam Chair, paragraph A then. The constitution of the new cooperative substitutes the memorandum of incorporation. It is a consequential thing, really. I turn the pages then with your permission, Madam Chair. Small thing once again on page 10, just below the middle. The new 72 capital B, it's paragraph B. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, that's my oversight. Thanks for that. And cooperative, that's what on page 9. Cooperative may be wound up voluntarily by a special resolution of a minimum of 60% and then just to make it very explicit of its member. The next one then on page 10, just below the middle, Madam Chair, that's small number 2. So if we read the preceding word, the Registrar or Tribunal may order that a co-op be wound up if, for a continuous period of 2 years, the co-op has not submitted annual reports or the equivalent thereof, one of the grounds for wounding up. I turn the page, Madam Chair, to 11, more or less in the middle there. Sub 2, in the event of the Tribunal not being able to transform the co-op concerned into an operational co-op, the procedures in section 3 relating to judicial management will apply. We turn to page 13, just below the middle, clause 64. Purely consequential, Madam Chair, not functions of advisory board, but council, simply relates to that. Once again, sorry, Madam Chair, that is my mistake. That whole portion of paragraph A is indicated between red square brackets. It means that it should be omitted from the book in total. So in our eventual document, we will not have a paragraph A at all.
Just a minute, yes. And just
refer
to the numbering,
then
if you're not going to have an A.
Advocate
Mandela?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I can just explain to members why this is the case. If you go on page 13 of that document and you read clause 63, you will say that you will see that there's chapter 12 of the Principal Act of Amendment by the Substitution for Expression Advisory Board for any recipient of the Expression Advisory Council. Therefore, what this clause does is by implication, wherever this word appears, it changes it. So unless we are making another change to a clause or a heading or a section, it's not necessary to repeat it in the bill. So wherever advisory board appears, we can leave it as that in the bill, because this clause takes care of that. You will see that the new paragraph A now, on your document, will surely be. Then we have Council E. But the reason is you are taking out a comma as well in that statement. So they need to show that this is how it will be.
And Chair, if we then turn to page 14, I need not say anything at all. What happened?
coming out of that downstairs, in respect to that one, that I ask to all day that we have on the page for the very same. The next one on page 15, 15 in the middle there, 91 capital B, it's a purely consequential thing once again, provided that deposit taking financial services co-ops, we've decided that it should only be financial co-ops, that the word services should get with it. On page 17, paragraph C, there is the reference to the new terminology. This is still a bit of a bone of contention, Madam Chair. Maybe we should keep it for today as to whether this is the correct terminology if we refer to the national co-ops. It's still a matter of debate.
Back again to the subcommittee.
Page 18, just about the middle, paragraph G. It's on the reporting owners to report or conduct any investigation on its own activities that are deemed necessary or as a result of complaint. I turn the pages, and Chair, I will now turn the number of pages. Please interrupt me if I want to get oversee something. Page 57. Small insertion there in paragraph B, page 57. Ensure coordination of planning and rest in respect of systematic settings in respect of couples. Small thing on page 38, the next page, that 91 double capital G, the Interprovincial Coordination Committee on Cooperatives, is hereby established. It's an oversight, Madam Chair, we apologize for that. The same thing on page 39, Madam Chair, on cooperatives. Once again, I think I'm going to make one call. And my colleagues have indicated to me that there's something on page 41 at the bottom that is a little bit more substantive than most of the methods that we've dealt with so far, that is indicated in purple, but should actually be intact. So can we please refer to page 41? 41, Madam Chair. Sorry to make you back. I've been taking the temporary assistance of my colleague. Top page 41, Madam Chair. It should be read. And this is, and we had a little discussion in the supplementary the other day, this appears to be a very, very simple insertion, but the legal consequences can be far too. I'm not going to refer to the link. We all know what happens in the Justice Department with the Section 10 principle, where you create a statute or Parliament has created a statute for the offence without providing for what would be the penalty or the sanction in respect of that offence. That is, if an offence is other than common law offence, but what we call statute of offences, there must be two lengths that it stands on, or else nothing is in place. So very important few insertions here relating to new statutory offences that would be part of the bill and that would carry the penalties that we provide for. Yeah. The next one is the page 43. If we can maybe take those two on page 43 B and C in or take them together, Madam Chair, because they run in sequence. So it will lead on receipt of the constitution of a co-op. The registrar must, and then we just go down to B. The registrar must issue a directive to the co-op, specifying in what respect the constitution of the co-op fails to comply with the provisions of the Act and in the insert and provider. Provided the registrar must clearly in the directive indicate the period allowed for rectification of the Constitution, and should the co-op fail to submit a Constitution that complies with this Act in the period so allowed, Section 2D will apply. So there is the others. If there is a mistake, it has to be rectified. If the certain period is not, the consequences are in Section 2D. I turn the page, and check, see what's going on page 55. It does not take a pretty.
Expressions respectively can be visible from the full colon
that they will respectively be substituted by invisible reserves. National ethics power is that the ultimate fear of this one, and financial power. The kind of umbrella provision, picking up all the words in the Act and changing them accordingly. Madam Chair, I am done.
Just a small point there, and again the same point on
64,
very small.
That is the memorandum of the objects,
Madam Chair. Members, we really have gone through here the work with respect to co-op today very effectively, and I think that's due to the work of the subcommittee, really, more than anything else, but also the fact that they documents are very effectively rounded in this regard. I think what we need to hear now is where we are and how much more time will be required. And to that end, I think yourself, Honourable Mabasa, as somebody who's working with us all the time, how much more have we got left to do more fully?
No, as I indicated with our initial statement, we feel we are getting to the end. So with the 1.5 to 2 days that we are proposing, the 4th and 5th of October, which will be during the recess period, we think we should be able to have a product which will be ready for the PC. But there are other areas that we will still debate as the subcommittee. And those areas where we have reached consensus, we will so indicate in the committee, in the PC. But where we will not have managed, we will then refer such to the PC to say we also need more deliberations from the broader PC. So I think with these ways, I hope, and also we will proceed with the principle of Advocate Anderson being at the task team level whenever she is needed, so that we don't duplicate argument. I believe I'm more or less trying to cover the subcommittee, but it's been something if members could so indicate. We do have the presentations from, because you remember that you said people have always had the door open to submit submissions as we go on to the meeting. So we do have submissions here. Members of the PC can look at them, but because we have not processed them properly at the subcommittee, we feel we propose that we don't discuss them today, so that we discuss them at the subcommittee, although they are available to yourselves as we speak. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Honourable Arthur. I think that we'll just, on that note, Mr. Wilson. Just until I remember the name. Mr. Herman, you've heard what the chairperson of the subcommittee is saying in terms of the substantive work that has to be done. And I've heard Ryan and that they're going to be meeting in the recess, well, not the constituency period, a couple of days to get on top of it. And that we then will be ready to come back on the 9th of October, that's the portfolio committee, as well as the 10th, you know, sort of working on the annual report and so on, and again, the 12th of October. Bearing in mind, of course, that the 9th of October is committee week, that's why we can use the Tuesday. So please don't let that worry you. There's only one thing that has been brought to my attention with respect to the co-op. And that is, given the nature, kind of different type of legislation that it is, and in terms of target grouping, if you want to put it that way, it is very important that rural areas should be fully aware of what we are doing. And I believe even in the World Cup, there were some rural areas that couldn't get reception, you know, that kind of thing, due to the geology and geography. Now, I think it's always a concern to committee when we believe that there are these pockets. Through no fault of our own, it would seem, we haven't even heard that the co-ops are coming up, you know, the legislation, etc. So I appeal to the committee secretary, Mr. Herman, to review the radio stations yet again, see what we could address. And every language, it's not excluding languages, and then where it's a language that someone doesn't speak, I'm sure it isn't called Shandong, but I mean someone used to refer to it as Shandong in my youth, there must be some other, but not everyone was aware on how to speak that language, I remember from teaching young men. So if it is a language, there isn't someone here who can speak it. We'll get some permission from them to use the closest other language in some way that perhaps those viewers or listeners may be able to understand the point I'm making. I'm asking the committee secretary to identify those radio stations which may be more accessible to those who may not have heard about what is going on, so that we can do what we've done before in our various languages. That just is a little backup. Of course, once we have taken a position and made recommendations to Parliament to take the legislation forward to the House, what we will be doing, which we don't often do, is to hold a press conference, a media conference on the matter, the same way we did with the steel, you remember, with the iPad. This is as significant a piece of legislation, albeit a very different type of legislation. And we will be doing that. Those of you who were part of that process, you will recall that. And we will make a clear, definitive statement on the matter, which we hope will go to all of our media people and entities on the matter. And I just hope that the department itself is taking cognizance of this dilemma we face with. Co-ops are intended to address everyone, the most vulnerable, and yet if they don't know about it, we have a challenge on our hands. I'm sure you all appreciate that. And though we can't keep on going around the country ourselves, NCOP are here for that, and our legislature, but that does not absolve us from the obligation to ensure as far as possible the work of the National Assembly reaches those for whom it is directly intended. Here, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Yeah, I can agree with you more, and I think every member of this committee would be more than happy to sit in that process of going out and speaking to radio stations. But I should say, we did that during the previous recess, and Parliament was kind enough to set up a number of radio station interviews with us. But whoever briefs those people needs to give them a little bit of background on what it is that you're actually doing, so that in our brief period on air, be it 5 minutes or 6 minutes or 10 minutes sometimes, we don't have to start with the very basics. I'll give you an example, Chairperson, of a very funny interview that I did with a rural community radio station. And the journalist asked me, what is it that we are billing government for? They had absolutely no idea what a bill and an act was. And so I had to spend most of the time explaining the very basics of what legislation is and nothing to do with the conference. So they need to be briefed, yeah.
I think in a written communique, that it will convey the very basics of this to our media office, who I know are with us from time to time. Shall we do that then? We'll commit ourselves and get Mr. Herman to work on that, because he doesn't have a constituency, we do. So of course he's the hard at work, shall we all assume. Having said that, members, we in honourable for love.
One of the provisions I made to the last time we did it was that we were getting deployed to community radio. So the outreach of the community radio is only that little area. But as well, the message and the message that was sent to a radio in
It's
the name of that.
Yeah.
I spoke to that individual, but only those people of that individual hit me. No one else. But if you, that we have developed a sense of radio, make it our record, provincial radio, and community radio. In the case of this issue, I think the issue we are discussing and parliament are issues of national interest. And there are channels in those places of all the different numbers. And you can be heard by not only the community of people that are speaking, but you can be heard by people from all over South Africa. Because the case of African people are not only speaking groups, they are all over.
You're attempting to read both points, you know, the so-called, is it policy or something? Yeah, the one I, well, the only one I really understand. So, you know, we are aiming to do that, but we also are aiming to go to those little pockets and make that clear. You see, so, but it has to be a balance. I hear what you are saying. So, I will converse with Mr. Herman, and anyone here, any member who wants to put forward a radio station, do so, please. Please do so.
We have national TVs and radio that are here.
I just get that. Compared to radio, it reaches far more people than TV. Honorable Salah, I love having people seeing my face on TV. And, you know, clearly you don't want to be heard on radio. But not really. The point is, reliably told, reliably, that radio has better and wider access. That's what I'm informed of. So, and besides the print statements and the media, what will have the TV? Okay, so let's be on the TV at the moment. Yes, Honourable.
No, I would rather say the proposal of Honourable Silabo because all he's suggesting is a complementarity. He's not arguing for the substitution of radio, but he is arguing for the complementarity. So that if we do nothing by the complementary approach of both TV and paper and radio, for all the better. Thanks.
You hear,
yeah,
that's not exactly what I mean, Honourable
Khadiri. Thank you, Mr. President. I think that is what the issue is here. So this this morning is your parliament. I'm hoping to understand. So I think that the chairperson ready. You have to when the house is sitting, because then that is you must arrange the section of arrangement interview with the hoping to be able to do that. I think that the phase one is your city. The other thing that you can
Honourable members, all I was saying is the people who come have not moved off the coast, all of them. And whatever means we can utilise, we also have a budget as it is. It looks like we will be overtaking it, but we've got good cause to. But we also need to know how to manage that budget effectively. Can we leave it like that? Yeah. All right. And so those issues, I think, are quite clear. I should also just inform the committee that we had hoped that we could send a delegation of three from this committee to the International Astronautical Seminar or Congress. And although we applied in July and we cut back again in August, September, you know, our chairperson, those could best have been surgeons. But the big office cuts me. You see, that's the point here. And he's thinking of the holistic budget of Parliament. And what has become clear is that it's necessary for science and technology and also the rural to be present there. So the three chairs have been deployed to go. But that will take place in constituencies. So we're going to fix the committee itself. I know that people think I'm trying to delay you, but I'm not. Just because we're going on constituency breaks, I'm trying to ascertain if there's anything there is. And I'm also, Debbie, you're the one who allowed me to forget. Can you quickly give a 30-second, 1-minute report verbally, please? You went on this industrialization thing. Was it to Durban, Free State, where?
Well, I think it's interesting. Last week I was invited by the Minister of Labour as a chief of his portfolio to go and attend the job summit. The job summit and the job fair in Dongkondi. It was a very good event. And then what is critical, Chairperson, I think that the whole area of new avenues of movement, which we have overlooked when we're dealing with the industrial policy and internal school. The one aspect which I think that is new, we have to accommodate that as well as the policy with the public hearing, is the issue of the maritime industry. I can make an example here. We are digitizing the education, digitizing trade, but all our changeable goods, which are ferried by sea, are being ferried by storages, which cost South Africa not less than 6 billion to ferry our own products to our country. There's not even a single ship which is registered in South Africa, although we have one of the longest coastlines as a country. So that kind of thing is very critical. There's a lot of potential, not only at the sea level, but within the province themselves. I can make an example. In the city that I was talking about, your wine, your orange, your colored or your grass, there SAMHSA is contemplating of creating a new shipping industry for that area so that we build it, so that the goods within the city themselves, they can be ferried to the river instead of their own. So that one is opening a huge opportunity for development, but not only in the city, even in the other provinces that people are must be used, which is critical. The other aspect which is very important is that on the average, when coming to South Africa, we are having about 9,000 vessels in a day in our coastline, which are very generous. But there's one thing which is not there. We don't provide enough space to the homes of the city and all of it. Of which we are trying an entire rate of unemployment, but we don't take opportunities in such a way that the other countries are actually coming to here, South Africa, open the basis here in South Africa so that you can take opportunities of that. I think that when things are that, we must do that. But what is critical then, this thing was a whole day. I'm also present, although I know that we wanted a one-pager. I'll be doing injustice if I can bring a one-pager issue. I requested the Department of Labor to immediately turn all the televisions to them so that I can pick up even the number of people who were employed in that day. Because once on the job fair, that's where they brought the business people and the potential jobs we have together. And then in the process, they were coming to take into the people who were employed there, they make the skills and then how. So it's got a very big thing, which I think that the Protocol Committee must have already the funds in reserve that. Well, that's been some of the members of the local community, because I have to keep the point of the minister. Our committee will not take me there. So I think that we have to talk to them about it. I'll make a complaint to the point. And because really, this week, I think I'm going to my office for the first time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman
Derby. We, in fact, this stage, they have actually asked this when Honorable Lewis made his input on the report, that if we can provide serious, substantive motivation, you know, in terms of our committee budget as to why it would be necessary for one or two people to be going there for different things related to our mandate. It's easy to say this and to talk, but if we can also have concrete evidence, so went to the report we got. Another member went to the report we have. This is concrete evidence that we've done this. And at what how supportive and positive it is. And in that way, rather than whining about not having enough money, etc., we can put a case forward for X and Y. So that is what we are going to do, and all of you members, I think, Honourable Barker has done that once with co-ops, if you remember, when at the 11th hour you were informed of you win. Am I right?
Twice,
yes.
When Chopra comes to the
Of course, I ran a medicine all over South Africa, all right. But members, that's the purpose of this. And having said all of that, I want to thank all members for their time, for their commitment to this committee. And also, the Honourable Satori has expressed a great interest in wanting to be here. It's just that she is a full-time member of, I think, is it Defence or Intelligence? Or, yes. And in those committees, of course, they do have these extra requirements. So she may be able to be here. So it may be that the whip and I can request Honourable Satori as an alternate member, which will enable her to fulfill all those obligations that she has. And on that note, I'd like to wish you an effective constituency period. Perhaps try to focus on work we've done, tell your constituents about it, and if you can convince them what you're doing is okay, and they vote for your party.